Welcome to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today. Remember, we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. And tell a friend, because our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime or pass the word on. Going to have an interesting show today. Going to be talking about the new possible proposal for a self plus one, a his and hers, if you will, health plan in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. It was recommended or authorized by the Ryan Murray, or Murray Ryan, as you choose, budget group, and is likely to be approved by the Senate today. And that would be a major change in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. Most people have applauded it up to now, but we find that a lot of people who are expert in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program and in group health plans in general say this is not a good idea. And one of them is Jackie Simon. She is Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees Union. Jackie, are you with us?
How you doing this morning?
Hey, thank you. I know you're on vacation today, so this is a labor of love for you. Thank you very much for being here. And Jackie, you're a trained economist, and you've been watching the federal thing for years. And I know that a number of federal agencies oppose, sort of in principle, the Ryan Murray bill, is thinking they could have done better. But also, secretly, many people are saying it could have been much worse. But AFGE went out of its way to question or criticize this self plus one proposal.
Yeah, I think that it's problematic. It's very interesting. If you go to the OPM webpage, they have under their frequently asked questions about FEHBP, why is there no self plus one? And on that page, they tell you that self plus one would be more expensive than family coverage, because the most likely enrollees in a self plus one would be two retirees who are more expensive than maybe a young family. On the other hand, of course, there are single parents with one child, or, you know, various combinations of two-person households that, you know, aren't necessarily older and more expensive to insure. I think the real answer is nobody knows. And, you know, as with so much that goes on in budgeting, these are guesstimates. The government expects that it's going to save money. And its argument now is suddenly that self plus one is going to cost less than family coverage, and so they think they've, you know, scored this as a savings, so that, you know, with the argument that people who move out of family coverage into the self plus one are going to end up costing the government less. So you know, they're speaking out of two sides of their mouths, and our concern is really because it's an unknown impact. And we think before you make a change like this, you should do a lot more due diligence and really find out the impact.
Well, Walton Francis, who is, I guess, the guru of the federal health program, he writes the Washington Consumer Checkbook Guide to Federal Health Plans, and he has been doing this for 30-plus years,
right,
both privately and with the Department of Health and Human Services. And he's not the most diplomatic person in the world. I quote him in the column this morning, and he said, enacting this thing was nuts. It may be something that will be scored as a savings money artificially, but it cannot actually save money. And I know a number of people are intrigued with the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. It's the biggest one in the country, covers almost 9 million people. In the Washington area, you can't walk down the street without seeing or touching somebody who is covered by it. It is a really, really big deal. And one of the things that makes it unique, in addition to the permanent employer match of a certain percentage of salary, is the fact that retirees are in it all the way. There's no differential for retirees. Benefits aren't different. Premiums aren't different. And that could be a factor, I would think, in this self-plus-one thing.
Yeah, there's all kinds of proposals out there from the Obama administration and members of Congress that would make some rather profound changes in FEHBP, both in terms of its structure and its financing. So, you know, when they get tired of picking on our retirement plan, sometimes they decide, okay, now we'll go after their health benefits, and then the week after that they go after our pay. So, you know, it's our enemies, you know, never tire of trying to reduce the living standards of federal employees. So, you know, this is you know, idea. You know, it's like I said, our concern about it is that we don't know the impact. After being told for so many years, and decades, that Self Plus One would be more expensive than family. Suddenly they've scored savings. And, you know, Walt Francis, you know, I don't have the data. He doesn't have the data. OPM is extremely secretive, the people who do FEHBP, and unwilling to share with us or with the public what they claim to know. They'll say, oh, there are winners and losers. Well, we don't know if, you know, who's going to be the winner, who's going to be the loser, and by how much. Then we look at the score and we see a savings. When the government's saving that much money, we know employees and retirees are going to be paying more.
Well, it seems to me for all of us, there are really two us's, two selves. And one is the one that wants to do the best for mankind and be fair and all of that. And then the other is ourselves, you know, survival, number one. And everybody wants to be in a group plan and take the benefit of the group rates. But once you're in the group plan, it seems that many people want to divide that up and tailor make it to their own particular situation. In the case of self only, self plus one, a family, and retirees, everybody has different health needs and requirements. And in many cases, people seem to want to tailor the plan, keep it a, quote, group plan with group rates, but tailor it to their situation and let it change as their age and medical condition and family status changes.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. I just, you know, like anybody else, after having been told with such certainty from, you know, the actuaries at OPM, we had, you know, we're certainly competent people. Suddenly there's a new generation over there that is saying, nope, forget everything we told you before, although they haven't taken it down from the website. This, in fact, is going to be a good deal.
Could it be some other reason than the cost that they suddenly discovered they were using metrics when they should have used the English money?
I honestly don't know. I mean, that's the frustrating part. No matter how many times we ask for information, we don't receive it. So,
why did this thing that was more expensive suddenly look more economical? Huh?
Exactly.
Hey, got an email here, if I may, from Bob at OPM. Says, don't want to use his name. Said, we won't have a chance to call in, but having the self-plus option will be a great thing for younger couples who don't have children and older couples like me whose children have flown away from the nest. Right now, lots of married federal workers are in self-only and let their spouses keep their own insurance because of the high family rates. For instance, Blue Cross Standard self-only will be $88 per pay period in 2014, while family will be $205 per pay period, or more than double. The family rate went up almost 5% this year, while the self-only rate went up only 2%. If a self-plus-one option can be only double the self-only rate or somewhat less than that, simple economics tells you more feds will migrate to that self-plus-one plan. Basic question for your guest who opposes opposition is, have they factored in this into their analysis, or is it just a guess? Follow-up question is, why would they want to limit feds from having the same type of options that many employees in the private sector and state and local government have?
Well, I think that my best answer to those questions is that we don't oppose it. We'd like to get more information about it. We're wary because although in the budget deal that's about to be voted on by the Senate, you have self-plus-one. The self-plus-one proposal was a part of a much bigger package that the Obama administration was proposing of changes to FEHBP, and now lawmakers are considering the Obama package as well as other changes to FEHBP. I'm not sure that this one change was ever meant to occur in isolation. And so my real answer to the guy who wrote in is, you know, not so fast. This one element of the bigger package may turn out to be really good for a lot of people, and it may turn out to be bad. We don't know. But there are some other elements to that package that are pretty unambiguously bad for employees. And we just have to sit tight and see what gets introduced on the Hill and see how, you know, what might find its way into the next package that tries to, you know, cut the deficit on the backs of federal employees.
Well, you make a really interesting point there, and I need to take a short break. When we come back, another question about the self-plus-one option. Be right back here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hey, Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with Jackie Simon. She is Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees and a trained economist. Jackie is on vacation today, so she's very graciously agreed to be with us. But she does have other places to go and be, so we'll get back to it quickly. And we were talking about the self plus one option in the Murray Ryan budget proposal, which is likely to pass the Senate today. And Jackie, you mentioned that there were Obama administration had a number of changes that it had recommended in the FEHBP, but that the conferees sort of cherry-picked this one out, the self-plus-one option. Do you recall what those other proposals were?
Well, one of them that's been very controversial has to do with creating regional PPOs that would compete with the national plans. And of course, would also compete with HMOs that are regional. And you know, one of the big fears is that Blue Cross Blue Shield, that runs the big national plan, would discontinue the national plan in favor of these PPOs because they wouldn't be able to compete because there are price differentials by region in the United States, and so. You know, talk about cherry picking.
Yeah.
There would be certain, you know, a few states maybe in the South or the Southeast that might be less expensive than those in the Northeast or the Northwest. I mean, I'm just throwing those examples out. I'm not saying that those areas are in fact cheaper. Sometimes it's not that way. But it would make the national plan either extremely expensive or not viable for Blue Cross Blue Shield to continue. I'm not saying that they have threatened to leave, but it would be logical for them to discontinue it if these regional plans went forward. And again, OPM's mantra, there'll be winners and there'll be losers. People in certain parts of the country would pay more than they do now, and other parts of the country, in theory, would pay less. It's basically, you know, more of what you were just talking about. You know, we have the benefit of this very, very large group, and the more you segment the group, the more you create winners and losers. And they want to segment that group by health status. For example, they want to charge different premiums based on your health status. So they would charge smokers more. They would charge people judged to be obese more. And, you know, that's certainly very, very troubling when you think about, you know, how that would be enforced. Would people have to take blood tests to prove, you know, they were smoking or not smoking? And, you know, there, more and more medical research is showing that obesity has as much to do with genetics as height. It's not all behavioral. And, you know, it just seems extremely discriminatory. So, you know, there are problematic things in this package. And again, you know, their favorite answer, winners and losers.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, don't want our members to be the losers.
And there is if it ain't broke, don't fix it aspect to all of this, too. The federal program is hailed by many people as the best in the country with its flaws and all that.
Right. And then there's the overarching thing that we have a very large, shall we call it a caucus in the United States Congress that wants to reduce the compensation of federal employees. They want to take money out of this program. They want to take money out by shifting costs onto employees and making the benefits, you know, less comprehensive. And so, you know, we've got that to think about every time we see a new proposal. It's not always quite so simple as some people would have you believe. And you have to look at, you know, who would be affected by this and by, you know, in what way?
I wanted to ask you, for the last 30 or 40 years, as long as there has been a federal employee health benefits program, Congress has been an integral part of it, as have the vice president. But, you know, senators, congressmen, and staffers have been in the FEHBP. They're eligible for the same plans at the same premiums and the same benefits when they retire. Now, January 1, they are leaving federal employee health benefits program. And I just wonder, down the road, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but if you think this might hurt the FEHBP down the road because Congress up until now has had a vested interest in making it the best plan in the country.
I think that's a really important point. Members of the Congress, not 100%, but certainly most of the members of Congress are quite affluent. They have a lot of personal wealth, and if they don't have personal wealth while they're in office, they have an opportunity to accumulate massive quantities of wealth as soon as they leave office. And they are not in the same financial position that a federal employee, certainly not the federal employees we represent. So they have a different perspective, and, we can just hear it now. We're in the bronze plan and the exchanges. If it's good enough for us, it's good enough for you. Of course, you can also afford your, concierge medical practice in New York City, where a federal employee, a GS-5, can't.
Yeah, no, that's a very important point. I think well over half of the Senate are millionaires now, either self-made, made it while they were there, or were wise enough to marry it, and a huge number of members of the House of Representatives. So there is they do see the world through a very different lens.
Yeah. But is that dangerous? Of course it's dangerous. And, we want the health insurance on the exchanges to be extremely high quality, and there's every reason to believe that it will be. And that's why we keep our eyes so strongly on the financing. And so do our enemies, to be honest.
Yeah.
Well,
Jackie,
take that away.
I know you watch this as closely as anybody in town, this budget formulation. Were you really surprised, as were all of us here, that this self plus one is the one benefit, if you will, slash a recommendation that emerged?
Well, during the budget negotiations, while everybody was trying to guess what would emerge, some information leaked out, and that was that in order to get something, the Republicans agreed to, wait a little while until they get their next chance to cut Social Security and Medicare. And the Democrats agreed to take any kind of tax increases for corporations or the wealthy off the table. So once those things were off the table, and they were going to replace, sequestration cuts, federal employee retirement became extremely vulnerable. And even though there is literally not one justification under the sun for touching federal employees' retirement benefits, the fact that it wasn't taken off the table along with Social Security and Medicare made us vulnerable. So we were expecting these cuts, even though we are now very, very focused on trying to have those cuts restored, because it is just an absolute outrage that they would go after federal employee retirement.
And while the increase right now is prospective, it's for people hired in 2014 and thereafter, you think the camel's nose is under the tent?
Well, yes, and, these people, we'd like to join AFGE someday. We'd like them to have a decent standard of living. I really can't get my brain around politicians whose great accomplishment is to lower living standards for the next generation. Why is that what they decided to do? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. This is just a tax on federal employees, not an extremely vulnerable, modestly paid, small slice of the American population was forced to shoulder a huge part of this package for no reason other than the fact that they could.
Well, I would think, particularly older people, that given what's happened to the federal workforce, the coming from both the Republicans and the Democrats and from the White House as well as the Congress, that people would be joining unions like AFGE in droves. It would be joining outfits like the National Active and Retirees in droves. And yet, I know everybody's struggling to get members. Do you have any sense, are we in a generation now that is just not accustomed to paying for anything?
No, we're not having any trouble organizing new members. People sign up for AFGE, and We've actually grown. We've grown substantially in 2013, and we've grown every year for the last more than a decade. So I think people, federal employees, when you tell them all the things that AFGE can do for them and the ways we represent them both on the job and on Capitol Hill and in the courts, they're pretty eager to join. And, you know, I got two kids in their 20s. I am not interested in, presiding over a situation where I'm helping lower their living standards.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of current employees feel that same kind of outrage. They don't want their kids to be worse off.
Yeah, that's not the American way. Jackie Simon, thank you so much for being with us. I know you're on vacation. You have other appointments. So go with our thanks, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Be right back. Hey, Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. Glad to have you with us. I'm going to be talking with Tom Timmon from our Morning Drive program. I know we had advertised that Sean Riley and Andy Medici from the Federal Times were going to be here, but they allege that they have other assignments. So I think it's awfully close to Christmas. I'm suspicious. But, Tom, thank you for coming in. You've been here since about 2 a.m., right?
Well, I've been up since 2 a.m. I haven't been here, but I've been here pretty early.
Yeah, well, thank you. This is
fun to join you.
Well, good, labor of love, and a little personal stuff about Tom. Tom is a very serious runner. He's done the Boston Marathon, the Marine Corps Marathon, and whatnot. And you're also in a band, which people may not know about, but I've seen you perform a couple times.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things to keep busy with, but when the winter comes, you know, everything tends to draw in on itself,
well,
I guess.
When we see you leaving here at 2 or 3 in the afternoon in your shorts and it's 12 below zero, a tip of the old hat to you. It's obligatory, I guess, in the business to do a sort of a year-end review. And, boy, what a year it has been. What a roller coaster we've been on covering this, and federal workers and postal employees and retirees waiting for the next shoe to drop. And I guess it started off with the furloughs, correct? That was something the Defense Department, for example, said I think they were going to have 22 days. Secretary Hagel really went in and did some serious looking around and whatnot, and defense managed to bring it down dramatically to, I believe, something like 6 days. But there were a number of people who were furloughed for 13 or more days, so that was for real, and they did not get paid back. The loan applications to FEA, the Federal Employees Education Assistance Fund, just went off the charts. Did you see the furloughs coming?
Well, I think you really have to back it up. The unprecedented thing was the imposition of sequestration. I think a lot of people did not believe that would ever actually happen, even though the Budget Control Act was in effect. But Congress is so at odds with itself, the Republicans and the Democrats, and even within the parties, frankly, that the sequestration came. It's like Lincoln said about the Civil War, all deprecated the war, all sought to avoid it, and the war came, as he said at his second inaugural. Well, and the sequestration came. Everybody was deprecating it and trying to avoid it. So that is what, of course, led to the furloughs. And I think really what that indicated was how poorly federal agencies, frankly, have a handle on what their finances are at any given moment. I mean, if defense thought it would have to furlough 700,000, a million people, they didn't know for sure, for 16 days, 22 days, I think was the original estimate, and it came down to just a few days and not everybody. Well, why did they calculate that so late? Why wouldn't they know that early? So I think it exposed a lot of weaknesses in the financial visibility or transparency managers have into their own agencies. But as far as an act in the lives of federal employees, yeah, it was really something.
Well,
no, I did not see it coming.
Yeah, showing how this works, too. When the sequestration started rolling, the Navy, I believe, said, we won't have to do it. And somebody called them and took them into a dark room for a few moments, and they came out and they said, yes, we have to do it, too. Sequestration reminds me of one of my favorite movies, the Cold War classic, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Love the Bomb, Stanley Kubrick. Peter Sellers plays a dozen roles, but in it, it's the Russians have created a bomb, and it's supposed to be something that will deter everything, and yet they forgot to tell the Americans. So the things get rolling. It's a horribly funny movie, and Sequestration came out of the White House. Bob Woodward wrote front page stories in the Washington Post that explained in great detail that this was a creature of the White House. It was a poison pill. OMB signed off on it. Treasury signed off of it. They took it to the Hill, both sides saying this is so awful it could never happen. And yet, as you said, it did happen.
Well, that's right. The whole incident, whether you look at the White House or the Congress, let's face it, did not show a lot of political leadership or pluck or any much imagination, really, because nobody can imagine not having everything they want, the complete and total policy of the land.
Yeah,
and you can see that in 1,000 cases, not taking political sides here, because you can see it from both sides. But really, the art of compromise being lost, I think, is what led to the sequester and the furloughs. So, the bad stuff does tend to roll downhill onto the people that had the least to do with causing it.
Yeah, well, I guess, this is a guess, I can't prove it, but I think that almost every generation says, in some respect, things have never been worse. It's never, the political climate
says that, yeah.
has never been worse. And if you read Gore Vidal's book, 1876, it's a trilogy, but the guy comes back to America from being in Europe. It's 1876, 10 years after the Civil War, and things have never been worse or more corrupt. And people say this now, but that, having said that, with all those caveats and asterisks, I don't think I have ever seen the political climate as nasty as it is now.
Well, that's right. I mean, yeah, the good old days, they were terrible. That was the name of the book I saw once in somebody's bathroom or something, in one of these books you can read real quick. But I would say you'd have to go back to the 19th century to see it that bad. I don't think it's been that bad in the 20th century. But if you look at the mid-19th century, politicians hit each other, shot each other, called each other complete horrible names in publications. Newspapers were nothing like even the biased papers of today, left and right. They were nothing like the scurrilous kinds of journalism you had back in the 19th century. So I think we've skipped back about 150, 175 years to get back to some pretty
minus
tough stuff.
The caning each other on the floor of the Senate, Bladensburg is now a suburb of Washington D.C. Bladensburg in Maryland, but there was the famous dueling grounds out there, and then there was a place across the Potomac River in the area that's now the CIA that was a dueling ground. So they're not quite as violent, but I mean, it just seems to me in the time that I've been covering it,
they used
to play the Republicans and the Democrats used to have a softball game, and then they graduated to baseball when someone in the major league pitcher was elected, I think, a Republican. But these people say they lived side by side. They lived in the same neighborhoods. They knew each other. They socialized each other. If you listen to the LBJ tapes, which CNN plays occasionally, you see that he's talking to Senator Dirksen, a Republican from Illinois, and he says, put Elsie on, and Elsie talks to Lady Bird, and they do social stuff, and you get the sense this doesn't happen now. You have members living in the House of Representatives building. Their families are obviously back home, wherever they come from. The TWT Club, the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday Club, is the way Congress runs now, and it's a very different climate. You think there's any – can it change?
I don't know whether it can change. I mean, but you're right about that. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, major pieces of legislation passed, agencies created, and they found some kind of common ground. Even the Vietnam era, as you and I both recall, there was at least civility around this. Now they've lost even the civility. And, Harry Reid had to apologize at some point using pretty language that was beneath a senator or beneath the chamber of the Senate. Maybe people have less respect for institutions than they did at one time. I don't know what the reason is. Can they get back there? I don't know. I think maybe we need some kind of a cataclysmic change. You know, everybody says they don't like their person in Congress.
Yeah.
Yet 90% of them get reelected. So people don't like Congress as an institution, but locally, nobody minds their own representative or senator that much.
And I always wonder, too, how much of that gerrymandering affects, because you now have congressional districts drawn by both Republican and Democratic state legislatures that are a joke. If you look at them, there's one in Maryland that looks like a Rorschach test. It splatters, and it's
spikes
drawn,
going off.
So that although we talk about having an election every 2 years for the House, that something like 80 or maybe even 90% of the districts are safe.
Yeah, and people, I think, I think people are not as engaged often in the local issues around their district and don't realize what possibly happened. I remember many years ago, I used to cover the town of Norwood, Massachusetts, and it had a big square where the town hall was, and the town hall was modeled after Princeton University, this big stone Gothic building. And two of the other corners had churches, and then the fourth corner had a park. And so a politician from Boston came out because he was running for Congress, and he wanted – and that town of Norwood was in that district, a little bit away from Boston. And the street going up was called Manhattan Street. And he gave a speech to the assembled good people of Norwood and said, I always love driving up Manhattan Street.
I'm a local boy.
Yeah, and seeing the three churches.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And
oh,
there was only two churches in town hall, and it was Manhattan Street. So, but that somehow doesn't seem to hit people as everything's online nowadays.
I love being here in California. Well, you know, maybe a throwback to those times. Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia, Republican, announced yesterday he's not going to seek, I think, a 19th term in office. Wonderful man, good for him. And then today, Steny Hoyer, his opposite across the river, a Maryland Democrat, put out a statement of, you know, talking about what a wonderful man this was and what a great public servant. And that reminded me of the days of yore under both Bill Clinton and George Bush, when those two and a coalition of Washington area politicians, Jim Moran and Elijah Cummings and others, but they would get together no matter who was president, no matter what the president was trying to do to federal workers. Hoyer would carry the ball when there was a Democrat in office. Wolf would carry the ball when there was a Republican. They'd round up people on their respective parties and staffs. They would do an end run around the president and get federal workers a much better raise each year under both Clinton and under Bush than they would have gotten had this coalition not formed. And I'm not saying that there's going to be a revival of it, but it does remind you that there was a 34-year period there, as Mr. Hoyer says, when that kind of bipartisanship worked very well for federal workers. We've got to take a break. Lauren Larson has given us the hook here, but we'll be right back talking with Tom Timmon here on federalnewsradio.com, Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Timmon today. Tom does the morning drive show with Emily Kopp, and he's been up since 2 a.m. and will be leaving here and going out and running.
All in a day's work.
All in a day's work, yeah. Talking about money. The 1% pay raise, that kind of a surprise to people, you know, given everything else that's happened, but it is on track, correct?
It is on track, and it's something the president wants, something Congress wants. I guess that puts federal employees in the 1% category.
Not the one they wanted.
But,
and
you know,
this was a Republican initiative, too, at the last minute, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. It was part of the Paul Ryan, Patty Murray deal to preserve that. And I think maybe there was some way the president could do it administratively. But, it was the Obama administration that has imposed the pay freeze for the past 3 years. So there's kind of an irony there, I guess. But, 1% doesn't mean everyone's going to get 1% across the board. It means that in a given work group, you have a 1% pool to use to pay people. So some people could still get nothing. Other people would get more than 1%. There's a lot of discretion in there. But on average, 1%.
You'd want to run a happy ship. Everybody better get 1%.
And the SES bonuses are curtailed. And the rank awards. I mean, there's still a lot that has lost.
The pay is very complicated, even for people inside government, because anywhere of about a third of the federal workers get a 3% raise every year, and that's based on the longevity step increases. And that doesn't show up in anything. Of course, it shows up in the salary aggregate dollars. But
correct.
So it's very tricky. Here's something that we had today on our front page of our homepage that I think nothing divides the world between inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway, beyond the Beltway. Nothing divides it like this federal pay gap. Now, according to the Federal Salary Council, which is made up of pro-federal groups and federal unions, the government now pays an average of 35.4%, talk about precise, less than the private sector, comparable private sector jobs. And in the Washington, Baltimore, San Francisco Bay Area, the gap is 49%. Okay, move over to the Heritage Foundation, very conservative-leaning organization, but
Andrew
they do
Biggs,
good
yep.
work. And they say that the federal government pays 2 to 3 or more percent better than the private sector, much more than that. And then the Congressional Budget Office, as your colleague Emily Kopp pointed out this morning, Congressional Budget Office says Uncle Sam has the edge by 2%. Now, I don't want these three groups working together on the next moon rocket if I'm going to be on it.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things about that. First of all, when I saw those reports coming out, I thought, you know, why now?
Yeah.
We finally have a budget deal. We finally look like we have some continuity and predictability to government relative to what we've had. And so it's like a couple that gets over an argument and then someone drags in one last little thing before they're ready to go to bed. Oh, now we've got this. Here we go again. The federal pay gap issue. Are they overpaid? Are they underpaid? The second thing I want to say about that is I don't think anyone really can make that. I don't think it's possible to know. You can look at a given job. All right. If you're a prosecutor and you are facing a real high-powered defense attorney in a criminal case in D.C. or New York or L.A., well, that lawyer opposing you probably makes maybe 10 times what you make as a federal prosecutor. But, you know, if you're a police person, a federal law enforcement agent, do people outside of the federal government make more or less? Probably about comparable. And there is no private sector, maybe security guards. Well, they make a lot less than federal law enforcement officers. So the comparison goes both ways. There are some things that feds do that are not done privately and vice versa. Scientists, probably about the same, federal or corporate. So I think it's impossible to know. And the third thing about it is, who cares?
Yeah.
You choose your life, you get compensated for what you do, and you make a deal with your employer and with the kind of life you want to lead, and that's the way it goes. I remember when I was in magazine editing, I used to complain, especially early on in my career when I did not make that much money. The salesman made all this dough.
Sure.
You know, they had company cars and all this dough, and I complained to the publisher. He said, well, would you like
a salesman.
He said, would you like a territory?
Uh-huh.
I said, well, I'm not sure about that. You know, I didn't want to do that work, so.
Right. And we're talking commissions and different things, too.
That's right. People that, you know, don't understand when you're on commission.
It can be downtime, too.
It can be downtime and you have to really like and get used to being told no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the pay thing, I mean, I don't think this is ever going to be resolved, and a lot of people, I think, are not aware of the fact that two of the staunchest critics of the federal pay system, and in fact, one of them blocked a federal law from going into effect that would have benefited federal workers greatly, were Jimmy Carter, Democrat, governor from Georgia, Bill Clinton, Democrat, governor from Arkansas. Now, Georgia is not a small state by any means, but it's when
It's not California.
When President Carter got here and when President Clinton got here, they were both astounded at the federal pay levels because they brought people with them. And they were astounded at how much people – I think the average federal worker in the Washington area made more than President Clinton did as governor of Arkansas. And so that was a shocker to them. And President Carter, in particular, made a drive for what he called total compensation. And that is not just salary, but the perks, the benefits, the value. If you get 26 days a year of annual leave, you think that's the norm. It is certainly not in the private sector. If you get a retirement based on your highest average salary and a guaranteed defined benefit, that is not the norm in the private sector, and so on and so on. Even with the Thrift Savings Plan, checked with the Employee Benefits Research Institute the other day, and the most generous plans in the private sector, it's 3%, and you have to contribute 6 before you get 3. In the federal government, there's 1 is automatic.
If you're lucky to have any matching.
Right. And you can get 5. Yeah, exactly. Most don't.
No, I think
so
federal,
the total compensation is something they never take into account.
No, feds have basically a good deal if you're a manager. It is not private sector incentive-based pay, you know, like in sales or any of those kinds of fields or capital investment and that kind of thing. venture capital, but it's not a bad deal, but it's a fair deal. And so if they have a better pension, I mean, so what? I mean, this is what it costs around the country. And so I think taking away is a bad idea. And I would ask Jimmy Carter, I would have asked him at the time, well,
why?
Buy a three-bedroom split ranch in Plains, Georgia, and try to buy the same house in Potomac, Maryland.
Right, and that's where the pay.
Or, you know, Oakton, Virginia.
Yeah, that's where the pay
Fairfax.
Gets.
So, yeah.
Okay. Got any predictions? I don't like making them, but I love asking other people for 2014.
The budget's going to pass. There will be no government shutdown. And we're going to have all focus on the 2014 midterms. That's what's going to occupy Congress. So everything they do is going to burnish the image toward 2014 midterms.
How big a deal is the debt ceiling limit? Because Mitch McConnell is making noises that it's not going to be as easy as these other things.
Well, he can make noises. I mean, every politician has their reasons for making the noises they do. And you have to look locally at what's going on in their backyard to get any kind of sense of whether it's real or not.
Very good. Tom, thank you for being with us. Tom Timm and Lauren Larson, thanks for working the boards. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week and stay safe.